Dearly beloved, I have to raise the question of money.
Yes, sir.
They raised the rent on me here to $50 a meeting.
A meeting?
A meeting. $100 a month. Now, interestingly, I thought before I was paying $25 a meeting, right, and I was actually paying $25 a month, they said, later. So actually, I've overcharged you for the last couple of months. So if I add another dollar on starting today, it'll cover it till May. Is that okay with everybody?
So
it'll be 19 starting today.
Can I add it next week since I already
got it? Yeah, sure.
This is the 28th.
27,
yeah. And then whether it's worth $50 to stay here or not is something we can think about, you know, between now and May if you want it. If somebody can find it, you know. You're essentially paying $4 for this room. And if you give me a free room, I'll knock $4 off. I just divvy it up that extra to the group. So if you're comfortable, if it's worth $4 a month, $4 a meeting to stay here, it's fine with me. If you come up with another place, that's fine with me too. So, and I thought, let's stay here till the spring. Let's not try to change in the middle. It's not that much difference. It's like another $8 more, something like that, for you. Let's see. Page. Well, let me do a review. We finished up the third parable last time, and we started the fourth. The third parable was basically about prison. Prison. Sophia was basically in prison, which we took to mean that the meaning of the experience was unavailable to the person having the experience. We talked about that, in other words, as that the content to be made conscious is projected. Hopefully this sounds familiar. We spent quite a bit of time on the psychological understanding of projection. Do I need to repeat that, or are you all comfortable with that? You're all comfortable with that, probably. A big comment that was made, which really sets the stage for the next chapter or two, is that the ego of the person having this experience, probably Thomas, was too weak to stop the influx of the unconscious material. So that he's discombobulated by it. He's overwhelmed. He can't. You know what that looks like in somebody's life when they're overwhelmed by the unconscious? They can't concentrate. They might not be able to get out of bed. They're not crazy. They're not psychotic, but they're so overwhelmed with a mood or a desire that they can't function. So that's what the danger is in these experiences, that so much is released that it just gets on top of you. And so what's going to follow but an attempt to control this thing? And that's where we'll be going. Now, that's an advantage and a disadvantage. It's an advantage because we don't want anybody to just get in touch with this material and then completely lose their orientation in life. It's a disadvantage because generally the person gets their feet back on the ground, but they haven't heard the meaning of the experience. They've just controlled themselves to willfully go back into their previous orientation. And that's what we're going to see in the next chapter. Yeah.
I was just going to ask, as we're progressing here, and I know we're seeing patterns, but can we maybe recap as far as like what the first parable was? I mean, just the statement, because this is kind of like, this parable was about being overwhelmed and trying to control.
Yeah.
I mean, just kind of like some of the things that maybe one goes through.
Let's see if I can remember myself. Well, the first parable introduced the experience. Okay. And the first parable, I would say, remember the title, Of the Black Earth. emphasize the depressing aspect of the experience. And then again, he really doesn't go through with it. He kind of flips into trying to understand it cognitively. I mean, we see in the very first, the story of what's going to be repeated, although the attempt to control it gets a lot stronger and more successful the later the process goes on. So I would say if you wanted to think of one word for the first parable, think of black.
Depression?
Depression. And then white. In other words, that he tries to flip it out of its depressing state. So the first parable is about being overwhelmed by darkness. And the second parable was overwhelmed by water.
Is there emotion or...
Yeah, I think all of it's emotion. The blackness would emphasize the depressing aspect of the emotion. The water would emphasize the discombobulating effect of the emotion, where you just lose ability to control yourself and to make decisions. Then the third parable is about prison. I think it is good because, you know, we're seeing so many images, your head just starts going, no. You do try to hang on to a word or something, and that's very valid. It oversimplifies, but otherwise you lose the forest for the trees. So I'd say black, water, this is parable two, three is prison, meaning that because he's overwhelmed, he can't understand the meaning of the experience. He's in the experience, yeah. And you know that beautiful T.S. Eliot line, that to have the experience but miss the meaning. That's something that I hope you fundamentally understand, the difference between having an experience and understanding the meaning of the experience.
And then you were even talking about in that memories, you know, that about the unconscious, you know, a meeting, the confrontation with the
unconscious,
yeah. Even taking steps to that where you apply it, too. I mean, you know, it's... A lot of it, you just keep at that. We even understand it, and that's just a head knowledge thing. Unless you actually bring it in.
Well, when he says meaning, or when she says meaning, that's just a word, but it refers to seeing what lesson you're supposed to learn in this experience, mm-hmm. what behavior change you're supposed to make out of this experience, what shift in the way you look at life is supposed to occur out of this experience. All of that. Is what we mean by meaning. That I'll give you an example. I was talking to somebody who was interested in RVing. I guess there's the whole cult of RVing now. People sell their property. And the individual was seriously... not seriously, but gave it some consideration. Getting close to retirement age, and then realized, oh, that is really my desire for freedom. But the freedom I'm seeking is a freedom that my voice be heard. So you see, the experience would be the desire to RV. The meaning would be that there's a lesson in that experience, which you only get by interpreting the experience. And that is some attribute, some quality, some aspect of your next step in life that you need. That'd be a way to think about what meaning is. That these things come to us, and we are so consumed by the experience, of the, you know, the desire or the dislike or whatever it would be, that we don't realize, oh, that experience itself is a metaphor. That's another way to say it. And the process isn't finished until you've realized what the metaphor is, and you do something about it. The phrase I like that Carl's referring to so much is that each dream has an ethical implication. You have to do something differently because of, and as a result of each dream. And Now, we're not really necessarily talking about a dream here, we're talking about a vision, but the same thing would apply. I think when I hear, I think the danger of beginning dream work is you forget there's an ethical implication. You're happy to understand it, and then you've got to realize, oh, but this is asking something of me. I think I might have mentioned to some of you, but somebody asked Jung why he didn't want to take LSD. Did you ever take LSD? No. Don't you want to take LSD? No. Why not? He says, I don't want any more experience I have to take responsibility for.
Now, I thought you had said that each dream was telling you what was going on in your unconscious.
Mm-hmm.
Without telling you what was right or wrong about it, or without making judgments. And now you say each dream has an ethical interest.
Well, actually, Jung said that in one sentence in the dream analysis seminar, and I disagreed with it.
Okay.
Do
you think each dream has ethical implications?
Now, ethical, be careful. I don't mean right and wrong.
Okay.
Like Ten Commandments, right and wrong. I mean, it's you have a debt to it. It's asking you to do something in your life.
Well, now, there had been something, I'm getting this from the dream analysis thing, but about the dream being in three parts,
yeah.
Where the first one was telling you
mm-hmm.
What
the issue is?
What the issue was. The second one is telling you different choices.
Mm-hmm. Complications and choices.
Solution. Solution.
Mm-hmm.
So is the solution the ethical
mm-hmm.
implication?
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah, this is the annoying part of the work.
I mean, really, all three are, because they're each requiring something of you.
Mm-hmm.
The first is requiring you to understand.
Really. Understand what the issue is.
What it is.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And then the middle one is, here are some possible, here's the amplification of that, and you have to understand that. So every piece of it is asking you to engage. It doesn't mm-hmm. just come in clear language saying,
mm-hmm.
here's the cookbook.
Mm-hmm.
So I think the ethic, you take it out of the collective realm and put it in the personal
mm-hmm.
realm, that you have mm-hmm. a personal
responsibility might be, but ethic gives you ideas that he's talking about Ten Commandments. He's not.
Can I share something?
Yeah.
I had a dream this week that really, it was so nice that it fit into those three parts.
Mm.
But just to real shorten them, the first one, I was running away from like an enemy coming into a city and taking what I could with me. The second one, I'm visiting a woman who has moved, and she has taken plants from her former home and is planting them on this hillside, which was a very steep hill, but
mm-hmm.
but it was working. The plants
mm-hmm.
were growing. And then the third one, I just get chills thinking about this. Somebody is chasing me, and I stop at this temple, and the person, the male catches up with me as if I caught you.
Mm-hmm.
And I turn around and look to the front of the temple, and these great big female eyes open up. And it's sort of like, oh, no, you haven't.
So I missed that. No, you haven't what?
You haven't caught me. You've been caught. Or you,
oh,
you know, this.
That's deep.
But I was thinking about that, and it's just the eyes. She doesn't have her mouth open and her
mm-hmm.
body, but she has awakened.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just, now, when you talk about ethical implication then,
mm-hmm.
how can you
stop running?
You stop running.
Your dream is saying, you stop running.
Yeah, okay. And that's the ethical
mm-hmm.
implication? Okay.
I mean, the implication is you have to stop running.
Mm-hmm.
And when you have stopped running, you will have fulfilled the intent of the dream.
Well, it was like I knew that was where I was going to stop running. I felt safe there, but I didn't know
mm.
that was going to happen.
Mm-hmm.
It was like I was as surprised as he was.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm working on a painting of it.
Mm-hmm.
But
it was deep. We can't do it justice here. But that's an example of an ethical implication. You are being told, here's a behavior of yours, you're running. Now, we don't know exactly what that would look like, but that would be the job to figure out how do you run and what behavior is an expression of that running. And then how are you going to stop doing that?
Well, I was just so pleased, though, that the three parts fit into what you had said.
It works.
Yeah, it was nice. It was nice that something...
Something worked.
Yeah, it worked. Gave me some information I could figure out.
Okay, so we were on just reviewing that brings us to one of the other main points we made on page 275, that there's a hidden meaning in the invasion. That's just what we've been saying. Again, I'm not trying to insult you by hammering you with points again and again, but there's so much material that I feel it's useful to take what is really central and just focus on that so that you don't get lost in all the detail, but you can always keep this axis going. This book is about extracting meaning from experience. And the invasion would be the overwhelming... overwhelming aspect of the experience. Now, we move to chapter 9, which is the fourth parable, and we're going to see here now a reaction to all the inner chaos. And I think the two main phrases in this chapter have been... Oh, I marked them down. Page 270, he tries to gain the upper hand over the experience. 278, to gain the upper hand. And I'll go back and review the whole thing. I'm just, again, trying to give you the meat. And the other one is that main point is on 280, that he tries to use the experience to reinforce his conscious orientation. But, apropos Jung's idea of compensation, the point of the experience is that he reorients himself. And I can't emphasize that enough, because if you listen to pop psych, it's all about reinforcing consciousness. How to make choices. How to take control of yourself. How to be a winner. How to succeed, how to not be swamped by your emotions, and so on. You see, it's all about reinforcement of the ego, which, as we said, is an important part of the work for a time. But what this book's about, and really what Jung's work is about that opposite situation where we don't try and reinforce consciousness, but we try to reorient it. And practically speaking, Freud did it all. What Freud did, minus some changes here and there, basically is about reinforcing consciousness. It's about the development of the ego. And for Jung, it's about the development of the self. There's a shift. And interestingly, I know we can't spend time on your dream, but one of the key images that comes around the axis of shifting from I reinforce my strength to I reorient my strength is the I. You see, somebody is seeing us. And that somebody has got a point of view, which we need to incorporate. And that's been where the reorientation starts. He cannot do that in this series of materials for two reasons. One, he is being assaulted by material that is so far from his view of life. He's probably a virgin. He is... not comfortable with the body, not comfortable with sexuality, and this vision is an erotic experience. That's only part of a reason. The larger reason is that the vision is not just trying to tell him what's wrong with you, here's where you need to develop. It's trying to show him what's inadequate about the whole interpretation of Christianity that was alive in the Middle Ages. So it is not only trying to evolve him, it's trying to evolve through him the understanding of Christianity and what is lacking in that understanding and how it needs to evolve. And it's presenting things to him that are so far in advance in terms of the future that there is just no way that they could be integrating. We are just now saddled with integrating the material that he got 700 years ago. So that explains why he's going to try to control the experience. How does he do it? He tries to show how the experience is really like he understands Christianity to be. And in specific, he's going to be saying, oh, this experience was a visitation by the Holy Spirit. So he's taking what is unknown in the experience, and he's saying, but I really know that. And this is what the church means by X, Y, and Z, name of the Holy Spirit. What is delicate here is he's partially right, and he's partially wrong. He's right insofar as Jung understands the psychological reality behind what people report as experiences of the Holy Spirit, as guiding experiences. This experience is meant to guide him above and beyond his ego. It is not the same because it is coming to him through the flesh, through matter. Matter is the symbol, no longer the spirit being the symbol. So that's the shift that he's being saddled with. So the chapter is basically a comparison of Sophia and the Holy Spirit. A confirmation, an attempt to confirm that this experience of the Holy Spirit, this experience of Sophia, is really an experience of the Holy Spirit. So he's going to show up all the parallels and ignore the differences.
But haven't we talked about Sophia being like Spirit? Or you mean the Holy Spirit? Or no? Is that where we're saying no? Because this is where I'm getting a little confused.
She's I would say, if you want to speak the church's language, that it is the Holy Spirit appearing in matter. That's the difference. And I do believe there is a slight emphasis, slight change in emphasis on what the Holy Spirit is saying, so to speak. Where the first manifestation of the Spirit at the time of Christ lifted people off the earth, this is trying to put people back on the earth. That's the difference. The number three played a big role. We talked about the psychology of numbers. I assume you remember that. One, unity, or unconsciousness, two, duality, three, dynamism, four, wholeness. And four and one are the same. So it goes one, two, three, four, but you could also say it goes one, two, three, one, because the four is a one again. And remember that the unconscious uses numbers as qualities, not quantities. So it can play with this, and it doesn't make a linear mathematics class sense, but the unconscious uses it in that way.
When you did number and time, we talked about the experience of Sophia through threeness and through fourness,
mm-hmm.
and I thought that was really good. But we don't, you know, she doesn't really talk about it so far.
No, I brought it in last time.
I might mention it, Brian, when we get to a spot where I talk about the painting.
Okay.
I think it relates to
okay
experiencing that spirit through.
You want to do it now?
Three or four. Do it now?
Yeah. Or would you rather?
Well, let's wait till we get to the part where she talks about leaving out Earth.
Yeah, Cal had mentioned that she feels that her new painting and this have some parallels. So I said, when you feel ready, holler, and you can discuss it. So it's up to her to pick the right point.
293, she starts talking about Earth being left out.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where I start to understand the painting. So when we get there, maybe.
Okay. We can come back to this number thing if you want. I'm just trying to review, because it's some of us did a whole course on it, and they're the ones that are here and seeing. The rest of us will try to fill you in on what it was really a difficult enterprise. With fear and trembling, I'm going to revisit Father, Son, Holy Spirit, because I think I kind of blew it last time. He gets, we're going to be talking about Jung's view of the Trinity. And he starts off by talking about Joachim's view of the Trinity. And I'm not going to repeat what Joachim says, because what's really important is what Jung says. But Jung does Joachim just to show that other people have interpreted the Trinity as actually three historical epochs. So, see, already Joachim is thinking symbolically, and he was a cleric. He's thinking symbolically with the Trinity, which is what Jung does. So Jung was saying, well, if he can do it, so can I. But Jung will be showing, or will be saying, that the Father is the world of law. And I said the Son was the world of law, and I don't think that fits. The Father is the world of law. In other words, the Father is one. And with the Father, you are identified with things the way they are. So you're playing by the rules. And you figure that playing by the rules is enough. So there's no reflection. They're simply following the rules. And a deification of the rules, that they are somehow immutable. You know, Piaget did that experiment with kids playing marbles. And up to a certain age, the reason you play marbles that way is because that's the rules of the game. And you don't change them. That's the way you play marbles. Yes, a kid, no, we're doing it. You don't change it. No. But at a certain age, they realize, hey, there's six of us playing here. We can change the rules. As long as we agree on what the rules are, it's fair. So that would be equivalent to the Son. Where law isn't taken as immutable, it's taken as a piece of data. And you realize, I have a choice here. See, there's no choice with the Father. You do what Dad says. But the age of the Son would be, or as Jung is saying, the level of consciousness of the Son, would be where choice starts to have a role.
My four-year-old grandchild knows that.
What's he know?
He knows that when he plays a game,
he can
change.
You can if the rules are agreed on by everybody, it's just as good as if somebody tells you the rules.
Except his older siblings don't want to change the rules. He's the only one.
Oh.
We don't know what's going on there.
Now he's between one and two.
Yeah, he is. And that sits
his. Yeah, some people never get out of one.
You know, as a Catholic, we call the Father the Absolute.
Mm-hmm.
There's no movement in the Absolute.
Right, that's the age. That's, yeah.
There's nowhere to go with
nowhere
it.
To go, right. And the Holy Spirit would be, that's number two, by the way. And the Holy Spirit would be both a three and a four. Three would be the Holy Spirit guides. But you tend to be a little dogmatic when you have received that guidance. Like, this is the way. And four is when that guidance is humanized by relationship, and you say, this is the way for me. It may not be the way for you.
That is a little philosophy. That's great. And then I've read some of that, like we've gone through the age of the Father, age of the Son, and coming into the age of the Spirit.
And you can locate where people are and where you yourself are on this.
Yeah, that's what I wrote down, what you had said in number and time.
Do I agree with me?
Yes, you do. Can we read what you said?
Yes, thank you.
You said, talking about the experience of the Holy Spirit through the idea of three or four, you say four represents completeness and the realization of consciousness. In three, you're tempted to make information from the unconscious an absolute truth. In four, you realize that the information is relative and shaped by your reality. Three proselytizes and four accepts. Consciousness changes truth in its manifestation. You add your point of view. It's not total subjectivity, though, because the objective psyche is involved. Your subjective view is based on an inner objective fact. Fourness is understanding this. Four is not mere subjectivity. You understand that your ideas of the absolute knowledge are approximations. You realize you must have a dialogue with others. You take what the unconscious has given you to the world for discussion.
I agree.
But I thought that was really good, really important, you know, in since when we're talking about Sophia, to divide that experience up like that.
Yeah, it does help you, I think, because here's part of the problem with all this stuff. See, in all of us is probably, where all of us are probably burnt children of the church, I would imagine, here. And we have, or having had either burnt children of the church, or we've had dominating parents, where you were just told, this is the way it is. And that's number one. And you make this enormous effort to overturn having your point of view shaped by somebody else. That is an enormous accomplishment. That's stage number two. Then you get to stage number three, and these damn dreams are doing the same thing to you that your parents did to you. They're telling you the way things are. And if you haven't resolved the feelings about being told the way things are in step one to two, all that's going to come back and keep you from going to step three. The difference is that your dreams are telling you what you need to know to be yourself, and your parents were telling you what you needed to know to fit in with their idea of who you were. But it's an irony that you work so hard in the stage of number two to get free of authority, to turn right around again and plug back into authority, and making your dreams, in a sense, have the same effect on you that your parents did. That is, you have to listen to them, even though you don't always agree with them. And then that leads again to a kind of rigidity, which has to again be sacrificed when you realize this is only my point of view. This is right for me. But I can't go around telling other people what the truth is. I can tell them what the truth is for me. And then I've hammered that out in a very hard way from inside. So these are some of the almost ironies or contradictions, you could say, that come up in this analytic process when you let go of authority, but then you have to submit to authority. And if you haven't resolved, it becomes very, very difficult to make that shift, to in a sense, to hear what those eyes are saying that are inside looking at you. But the Sophia experience is meant to be an experience where Thomas or whomever begins to see himself as Sophia sees himself, and he can't do that, so he's going to say, "So, see, Sophia is really telling me everything I know about myself and telling me how right it is."
So he keeps going back to the one phase, the law?
Yes. Yes, I'm afraid he does. Uh-huh. And the last point was on 283's way of review, and we talked about how the alchemist, Jung mentioned that the alchemist saw an analogy between the light of nature, now do you all remember the light of nature, and the Holy Spirit? Again, there are similarities and there are differences. The light of nature would just be, I think, pretty close to another word for Sophia. Sophia, if you take Sophia as the guiding intelligence, which is to be found in a material experience, and I've tried to sum it up by saying sex, aggression, disease, or synchronicity, and that's a little bit of a formula, but to give you some orientation, then that's the meaning in the experience. The light of nature is the meaning in the experience. The understanding, which is within the very experience that you're having, if you can understand it. And that's where we left off. Are you comfortable? Now we're going to, I've kind of explained this, but let's read through it, and if it makes sense, I won't belabor it, but if it doesn't, we can stop along the way. Some of this we're going to zoom through, because after a while you can only hear how Sophia and the Holy Spirit are the same. We're just going to go right through it. Some of it we're going to go very, very, very carefully in. These two pages we're going to go very carefully in. So I'm on page 24, second paragraph, 1, 2, 3, 4 lines down. What they called the spirit in matter, or the paraclete, we today call the guiding function of the unconscious, which is experienced as meaning. Do you want to try to give me a synonym for meaning?
Integration.
there's, that's part of it, but there's a key assumption we take and we make in Jungian work.
Personal knowing?
It's no more. It's all included.
Consciousness.
Yeah.
What
did you say? Consciousness. Another way might be to put it, when do people feel they are living a meaningful life? And when do people feel they are living a meaningless life? I'll give you a hint. It has nothing to do with pleasure. It can be a very unpleasant time and be felt as a meaningful time.
There's a filling.
When do you feel that you're filled?
When you're being true to who that...
Right. The idea is that, you know, you're here first and that there is a way for you to become the person you are. And when you're taking those steps that are en route to becoming the person you are, you feel that you're living meaningfully. And when you are not, you don't feel you're living meaningfully. So what the Sophia experience is, it's information about the next step on that path, which is the fulfillment of why you were put here. So you really can't describe meaning without this reference to what we call the a priori. Yeah, the a priori self. So the Christian word is the paraclete, Holy Spirit. Jung's word is the transcendent function. What's the difference? The difference is that Jung doesn't say, I know what the metaphysical reality is behind the experience. It's the only difference. It's a good point. The difference between a Christian saying it's the Holy Spirit and Jung saying it's the transcendent function is that Jung doesn't try to describe the metaphysical reality behind the experience. He accepts that there is something outside the ego which guides the ego. A Christian is going to say, that's God. Jung says, maybe it's God, maybe it's Allah, maybe it's the void, I don't know. And I am not going to try to put my statements in the place of religion. I'm simply trying to show what happens in the psyche under certain circumstances. Personal opinion, because I'll talk to theologians about this. It's like talking to a brick wall. But Jung replaces, the way I put it, Jung replaces metaphysical certainty with ethical obligation. In other words, when I have a dream that guides me, I don't care where it comes from. I don't care whether it's from God. I don't care whether it's from the void. I don't care whether it's from my brain chemistry. All I care about is what it's asking me to do. And when I fulfill what it's asking me to do, where it comes from isn't important. So I want to say to the people who are harping that Jung psychologizes religion, that it doesn't matter whether we say there's a metaphysical reality behind it or not. What matters is that you are following the directives, and when you do, the other question just dissolves.
Except some people would say it's the devil. Some people would say that in other words, where that's coming from, is that a place for good or for ill? And I
would say you might be right.
The question.
I would say you might be right.
Mm-hmm. But then there's the factor that someone might say, well, it's me, it's coming from me, and then that's an inflation.
Yeah. You see the inflation when you ask them to take the directive seriously. Suddenly it doesn't become so much me anymore, because it usually involves a sacrifice.
Then it's the world or something.
Yeah, then it can become projected. Yeah.
Okay, you said earlier it's object, but it's something object, but it's not object, or is it something different than discussion?
Right? No. There's a whole philosophical school that says that your experience is nothing but an interpretation. It's called postmodernism. And I think we have to accept some of the truth of that. Because, see, that's number four, in a sense. But Jung also doesn't want to let the argument stop there. Because he says, okay, my knowing of the thing may be subjective. Or, put it this way, my knowing of the knowledge may be subjective. But does that mean the knowledge is subjective? In other words, remember that example of the woman turning in her paper and the truck of Pegasus driving by. Jung is saying, I mean, he's not saying, he's asking a question. How did that truck know to be there? And that was not the presence of that truck was not a subjective creation of that individual. It looks like there is a knowledge in nature apart from the individual. That truck, so to speak, knew to be there. So he doesn't want to say all knowledge is subjective, but that our knowing of that knowledge is subjective. Because then we are saddled with the problem of asking, do I know what is going on, and not just gloating in the fact that it's simply my point of view. That I'm forced to begin comparing my knowledge with the fact that there may be something objectively happening. Is it making any sense? There's a whole, I may have mentioned this before, I don't know if I did, stop me, but there's a whole school of psychotherapy that's based on this. Of course, they all deal with the unconscious, but that everything is just a point of view. It's big in marriage counseling. You have your point of view, he has his point of view. And I was working with a woman who was seeing one of these therapists. It drove me crazy. Her husband was abusive. And it was his point of view versus her point of view. And one day he punched her in the face. And I said, now whose point of view is that? See, there is something happening. And this, the danger of saying everything is subjective is that you miss that there is something happening. These are the problems you get into. But I don't know if it's useful for you to hear that or not. But we're trying to both recognize the fact that we are confronted with something we have to come to grips with, on the one hand. And then on the other hand, that it is me coming to grips with it. And there's both a subjective and objective component in it. And we would like to say that this Sophia experience is something objective. The self does know who you are to become. The question is, do you know that knowledge? And your knowing of that knowledge is always an interpretation. I don't know if that makes sense or not. Anyway, the psychological significance of this shift of accent to the third person of the Trinity presents such a deep and far-reaching problem that I must refer Jung, further reader, to Jung's discussion of it in a psychological approach to the dogma of the Trinity. So now we go to Jung's understanding of the Trinity. And he's going to be saying what I've just said, so this will be hopefully familiar. The Father, conceived psychologically as a symbol, notes the earlier state of consciousness when one was still a child, still dependent on a definite, ready-made pattern of existence, which is habitual and has the character of law. It is a passing, unreflecting condition. So people in that state, you know, have dreams. There's no light in the room or something like that. A mere awareness of what is given without intellectual or moral judgment. But the picture changes when the accent shifts to the Son. The situation then calls for conscious differentiation from the Father and from the habitus represented by Him. This requires a certain amount of knowledge of one's own individuality, which cannot be acquired without moral discrimination. It cannot be held on to unless one has understood its meaning. Habit can only be replaced by a mode of life consciously chosen and acquired. So see, there the emphasis on freedom of choice. And there is pop psych. But you get rid of your old baggage and you make new choices. The Christianity symbolized by the Son, therefore, forces the individual to discriminate and to reflect. Now we come to why we're talking about this, which is Sophia's as the Holy Spirit. The third step finally points beyond the Son into the future, to a continuing realization of the Spirit. That is a living activity proceeding from Father and Son. Let that sink in for a second. The Holy Spirit comes from the Father and the Son. So the Father is the law, and the Son is the choice. But the law is going to be now not the outer law, but the inner law. The Son represents a transition stage and a state of conflict. Not only is it in opposition to the still existing earlier state, but freedom from the law brings a sharpening of the moral opposites. In the third stage, the patriarchal initial state is, in a sense, reestablished. That's what I was trying to get at, that you go back to being told what to do again, but by your dreams. And it's, in a sense, established. But it is not just a repetition of the first stage, for the values of the second must be held fast. That's what I was trying to say about it is both objective and subjective. Though the new level of consciousness acquired through the of the Son continues in the third stage, it must recognize that it is not the source of the ultimate decisions and flashes of insight, which rightly go by the name of gnosis or knowledge. Does that make sense? So you have dreams, you have images, you have intuitions, but you realize you're having them, you aren't them. And you have to hear what they say, and they may be in contrast to what you think and feel.
You're having them, but you're not them. Mm-hmm. You're saying they're coming, okay.
In this third stage, I don't know if I ever mentioned it, I saw a cute bumper sticker, "Don't believe everything you think." That's kind of close, that you realize you can have thoughts, you can have feelings, but you have to critique them. And sometimes you need to realize they are incorrect, and sometimes you need to realize you are incorrect, and they are correct, and you need then to begin thinking the thoughts that have occurred to you. Is this making any sense?
Well, how do you find out? I mean, you're talking about, how does it get clear which one is which?
Well, this is what we try to do in our dream work.
Right.
And you sort of learn in a test tube phase, and you kind of get used to having, like I will, at the end of the day, I will write down my thoughts and feelings. And then in the evening, I'll see what I dream. Then the next day, I'll compare the two. And I'll see, are any of these dream figures symbolic of what I was thinking and feeling that day? And if the feeling is, if the dream figure is trustworthy, that will give me a clue that what I was thinking was on target. And if I dream of a element that is not trustworthy, I have to realize, well, that judgment or that thought or that feeling I had yesterday may be an error. And so you begin to learn about your own experience from this inner dialogue. And it is painstaking at the beginning, because you're so used to saying, well, this is how I feel. But maybe that feeling is a complex. And maybe that feeling is wrong. And maybe that feeling is not an accurate perception of the situation. So what we try to do with the inner dialogue is allow ourselves a way to critique that experience. And then if you can do that to yourself, you're much more able, if you're in a bad mood and your spouse says, what's wrong with you, to stop and reflect and say, oh, maybe I'm off here, I'm sorry. But it generally starts with the capacity to critique your own experience, and then you can receive the feedback from other people where your point of view is off the mark. And this is part of that third stage.
important component of that. There is a feeling element to it.
Yeah.
Because it's that classic click that they talk about. And the way I think of that click is, does the click take me deeper into myself or does it pull me out of myself? And so it's a felt experience. And if all of a sudden I get that click and I kind of pulled out of myself,
mm-hmm.
I have a sense it's my ego.
Because mm-hmm.
it's kind of reattaching me. So it's a feeling.
Yeah. Ultimately, it comes down to a feeling.
So and that's what you... That's for me what I've had to learn to get in touch with
yeah.
is my body
yeah.
and how in that moment, that click, it's not just a mental click. It's one that sort of takes me deeper.
It's an emotional, physiological click.
Right.
And probably if you were raised by rotten parents, they knocked this out of you. Healthy, you know, people who are naturally, spontaneously healthy have this ability. But if you had a rotten upbringing, you've been taught, this isn't what you think, this isn't what you feel, here's what you think, here's what you feel. Now, there may be many ways to restore that sense of judgment, but the way Jung has worked out to restore it is that you enter into a dialogue with yourself. And over time, when one processes one's experiences through the dreams, you do get to realize there are patterns in yourself, and your feeling can pick it up.
I just want to say that where I'm at, though, I have to really work through what I'm thinking of, what I'm relating to is what I'm feeling isn't necessarily the truth. Kind of, so I understand coming in touch and getting that click, that feeling, but right now I think when it's trying to figure out what I'm even supposed to do.
It's hard. It is damn hard.
And what I would say is it's the feeling of the feeling.
It mm-hmm. ultimately lets you.
Yeah, but
because there's feelings that can right. take you.
But particularly if you're doing this work, remember how many people don't have that. And you've got to help them begin to trust in their own judgment again. And the reason they don't trust it, maybe their judgment isn't right. That's how they keep getting into bad relationships and bad experiences and getting swindled and so on.
Well, and that's what, too, though, I think part of it is like if you're saying the fact that if it doesn't feel right to still stay with that,
mm-hmm.
you know, until it kind of works out, because initially you want to just get rid of it, and you may feel better for a while, but then what? You know,
mm-hmm.
I haven't stuck with it long enough to find out what it's saying.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because right now, yeah, what I was feeling, I mean, I get little breaks, but I think it's one thing, and if I go do that, well, maybe that wasn't it, because I still have that tension. So it's been interesting. It's been really interesting.
And often there is, in what is an error, and this is not about getting back to Sophia, a truth. The guy who, I was telling you, had the fantasy of buying an RV and selling all his goods. Now, a person with no reflection might have done that. But he reflected on that experience. And he said, is that a genuine desire? And he realized, no, it's not. But there's a seed in there which is telling me I am seeking freedom. I just need to find it in another way. So these Sophia experiences often come on in this aggressive sexual sense, and the actual point of view you're having in the experience is wrong. It doesn't mean that the experience is meaningless or that you're not supposed to get a meaning out of the experience. Again, that's why, to my view, the stage two version of psychology, which says that experience is unrealistic, make your right choice, misses the fact there can be meanings in the false experiences. It's very complicated. To both stay true to reality and stay true to the intent of the unconscious.
So people not reflecting usually act on it then?
Usually you find two errors. Either they repress it mm-hmm. or they act on it. They've learned that if I trust these feelings, I get into trouble, so I'm just not going to have these feelings anymore. And the other error is, hey, it's a free country, I'll do what I want. Yeah. So what we're doing now is taking the Sophia experience, we're trying to make it kind of practical. How do you work with it, and what's it look like, and what level of consciousness does it take to work with this? But these are inspired. So we're talking about, let me go back. It must be recognized that it is not the source of ultimate decisions. The ego is not the source of ultimate decisions. Flashes of insight, which rightly go by the name of Gnosis, but that these are inspired by a higher authority, which in a projective form is known as the Holy Spirit. Psychologically speaking, inspiration comes from an unconscious function. Accordingly, the advance to the third stage means something like a recognition of the unconscious, if not actual subordination to it. See, you were subordinate in stage one, you were sick of it. And here you are subordinate again. it produces a lot of trouble in my office. This one. You sound just like my dad. I came in here, and you're telling me what to do, and you know, I worked, I was an ex-wife therapist, and they told me to do what I want, and I'm telling you what I want, and you're just one more person telling me what I should do. But it's not me, it's their dream. I'm just the vocal point. But you see the fire you get into when you come back to this subordination to the unconscious. Although it's not actually a subordination, because you have to be able to decide. But it sure feels like a subordination. The transition from one stage to another, are the transitions are, as Jung emphasizes, very fateful transformations indeed. You can imagine the emotions that were. I remember I was talking to a woman recently, came in, huge problems, lots of dreams of running away, and then she announced, oh, I want to come once a month. I said, I'm sorry, I you know, it's ridiculous, there's no point coming. Last therapist told me I should say what I want, and I'm in here telling you what I want, and you're telling me not to do it. You know, this is lousy therapy. And I could not get across, but your dreams show that this is your running away. And she left. She couldn't subordinate to that inner voice which says you've got to stay fast and deal with these emotions. And that previous two-stage therapy, which in a way is right, you should be able to say what you want, thwarted her own development.
And Sam doesn't test that part of being in that.
That's what he says, fateful transitions. It gets hot at these places. It gets hot when you go from dad to son, because you want to be told what to do. And it gets hot when you go from dad, from son to Holy Spirit, because you're sick of being told what to do. And there are a lot of emotions that come up. And often, people don't make this shift until there's a crisis. Something bashes them where they can't continue in the old way. Just such an experience is described in Aurora. Wait a minute. Very faithful indeed. Usually they have a numinous character, blah, blah, blah. Just such an experience is described in Aurora. Moreover, it is a description of the transition from the second to the third stage, which is why the recognition of the Holy Spirit occupies a central place. That was the point of all this talk, to give you a sense how this fits in to a schema of development, what that schema looks like, what are the strengths and weaknesses that you have to bring to this experience, what does it ask of you, how does it look, and so on. And really, you can see it involves some deep philosophical questions. What is knowing? And it sounds like just something you say blah blah in a seminar, but there's a woman made a decision to leave a very competent therapist because she couldn't know what was going on. And there was no way of getting across, honey, you're gone from two to three. You do two, but you keep making bad choices. Okay, let's take a stretch.